Welcome to the Awaken Therapist podcast, where we explore a holistic and transpersonal approach to psychotherapy. In season four, you'll hear live therapy demos, case consultations, and dynamic teachings designed to awaken transformation in yourself, your clients, and the world. I'm your host, Harmony Quiker. As a psychotherapist, author, and visiting instructor at Naropa University, I created this podcast to empower you to deepen your presence, expand your awareness, and trust the sacred unfolding that happens in authentic therapeutic contact. To learn more about our trainings, community, and resources, check us out at awakentherapist.com. In today's episode, I'm sitting down with Kara Crosthwaite Brindle. Kara is a licensed therapist, certified financial therapist, speaker, author, and entrepreneur who specializes in helping therapists build secondary income streams to protect against burnout. You'll hear her insight on financial health and why diversifying your income matters. We talk about burnout, self-worth, money, and how creating additional streams of revenue can support your long-term sustainability in this work. As I was sharing with you, I invited you here because I really do see you as a therapist who's so dedicated to empowering other therapists, which is something that I admire and share in that vision with you. I think it's so important to have spaces for therapists that feel sacred and enlivening. And so, yeah, thank you for doing all this beautiful work.
It means a lot to hear. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by talking about just the financial reality of being a therapist. I had a young high schooler actually reach out to me recently who is thinking about going down the path to become a therapist. And she asked me, can you actually make money doing this work? And so I'm wondering what you would say about that.
I think the answer in my head was a yes and dot, dot, dot. I'm sure that'll make sense to your listeners. Like, yes, and it depends. I mean, it depends on the work that you do. I know we're going to talk about this in detail, but like, I believe the modern therapist does more than one thing in their practice. Like, it might not just be seeing clients. It might be seeing clients with other income streams. I don't know if we make good money if all we do is client work, just in the time that we are right now, the time and place. But yeah, I think it's a yes and to the high schooler's question.
Yeah. And, you know, I loved the question because she wants to make money and she's thinking about her future financial health, which I just thought was so beautiful that she was being that mindful about this. And there is this quality often in this field about noble poverty. And so I would love for you to define noble poverty and how you see that come through in the financial health of the therapist you work with.
Yeah, so I discovered noble poverty as language for this experience back in 2021 when I discovered financial therapy. And so in part of my work, I had to do my own work to become a financial therapist, and now I do that work with other therapists. But noble poverty, for folks who've never heard that before, describes putting ourselves in financial distress to serve others. And so therapists usually get a gut punch when I say that, or like a shortened breath. And it really just puts language to something they've always been told, even at grad school. Like, it's been reinforced from there forward. So I love that this next generation is having more candid conversations about the reality of our field, because it's not something that's happened, at least for my education, possibly your education. It was, no, you will be a good helper. You will not make good money. That was the message.
And there's also this question of, can I serve the underserved population and still be financially well? And I think that that's where secondary income streams are so important. When I was a new therapist, my mom passed away actually right after I graduated, and I knew I could not see clients. I was just a complete wreck. And one morning I was watching the Today Show, and this was about 18 years ago. Online learning was like a new concept at that time. And somebody was on talking about how a person with a master's degree can have a secondary income. And they said, teach online. And I literally turned the TV off and I went and researched, like, where can I teach online? And so when I was building my practice, I already had that secondary income like built in. How did you arrive here? Was it becoming a financial therapist, or did it happen earlier for you?
I think it happened as the result of professional burnout. So that feels very like true to our field as well. Like not only are we questioning financial health, we're also questioning, can I do this for long periods of time? And so in a conversation I had earlier today, I like to tell people there's a stat I discovered of like the average licensed counselor is in the field for 7 years. That's it. And people usually are like, oh my God, all of that investment and time and energy and financial investment to get a master's degree, and you're only in this field for 7 years. Now, I want that study to be recreated and I want all the designations to be studied, right? So social work, anxiety, and all the others. But that to me normalizes the noble poverty a little bit, and it normalizes that we need to have something else beyond client work. And so I had professional burnout from 2016 to 2018. It's kind of when I pinpointed when I finally had a true conversation with myself of like, how long was I burnout? And it took 2 years to actually admit that I was in it. It took a health crisis to admit I was in it. Nothing else, like no intervention from a loved one, nothing a colleague said to me landed, but putting myself in a health crisis and one small thing my spouse said woke me up. And at that point, it took me a year to recover. So I think people started coming to me in 2019 when I started getting vulnerable with, hey, I've been in burnout. It's not great. I want to help you not go through it. And I think organically, my secondary income started there with some consultation with other colleagues. And now at the time of our recording, I have like 14 income streams, which sounds really impressive, but they're like little drops in the bucket.
Yeah, and when I hear that timeline too, I think about how that all sort of got started right before sheltering in place with the COVID pandemic, and which is where the first, which was really the first time I felt burnout. How synergistic that is, that that's really where you started right before that.
Yeah, and frankly, I feel like it needed to happen in 2019 because 2020 was so awful for lots of reasons. And I started burning out again in early 2021, and that's when I discovered financial therapy. I was like building one of my many entrepreneurial projects with the excuse of talking to colleagues because I was working at home, not talking to anyone. And so I was interviewing them for like this business entrepreneurship thing I was doing. And someone mentioned financial therapy. I was like, what the heck is that? And so I found a financial therapist in our area. I brought her on to the little thing I was building. And within 20 minutes of hearing her speak, I was like, oh, like lightning bolt kind of feeling like, oh, this is what's missing from the consults I'm doing with therapists. So it just really solidified my population was narrowing down to just therapists. And I was going to help them with that noble poverty. But it also meant 6 months of my own deep, ugly cry work with her. So within 24 hours, I was like, hey, can you mentor me? Can I learn how to do financial therapy? She said yes. And 6 months of that. And then I started taking on clients. And it's been a beautiful, interesting dynamic of like, wow, there's so much here, but it's not nearly as exhausting as other trauma work, which is what I needed for my own nervous system.
As I'm listening to you, I started thinking about how when we don't have a secondary income stream, so much pressure is put on to every client showing up, not taking sick days. Can I afford a vacation? I'm wondering your thoughts on that and what you've seen.
Oh yeah, especially in private practice where we don't usually have PTO unless we build it in. That is the game changer for listeners of like, you want to consider PTO, pay yourself to take time off from your business. But that wasn't a natural thought when I started private practice in 2016. It was like, oh, I'm going to work all the time. I'm going to think of my business 24/7. I built into a group practice like within 6 months because people were coming to me to serve Medicaid clients. At that time, there was not an open enrollment. Everyone can take Medicaid. So it like happened that way. But gosh, I never took time off. And when I did, I felt guilty. And so that was the start of the burnout of 2016 to 2018. So yeah, I would love for folks to think about how do I have like a cushion account or like a little savings account for that to pay myself to go to a conference, have a mental health day, to take a vacation. It truly is the game changer that I help people discover now as a financial therapist, but that was not normed in grad school or anywhere in between.
Is there a percentage that you suggest for people to be putting away for that of their income?
Not necessarily. So, as a financial therapist, everyone's emotions get in the way of having it be that structured. And so, what I usually invite people to think about is like, what is a number that feels good to you? And for some folks, that's $5, and for others, it's 50, right? So, depending on how scarce they feel with their money, how tight things feel, I let them pick the number because any amount is better than none, right? So, if it's like $5 on auto pay or like $5 put in an envelope somewhere, that matters because even for a vacation, let's say your vacation costs $2,000. you only have $500 saved. Well, $2,000 minus the 500 is still going to feel more bearable and comforting than, oh, $2,000 and no payment towards it. So there is something psychological about even a small amount feels better.
Yeah, I like that. I can see that, like getting paid $500 while I'm on vacation is better than making nothing while I'm on vacation. Yeah, I love that
And
so
it's just like the
much.
perfect storm, right? When you're like, oh, I'm on vacation. Not only am I spending money on the vacation, I'm also not getting paid for the week or however long I'm gone. So it's just like this perfect storm of awfulness for clinicians in private practice. And so now I'm encouraging them when they are able to have that cushion on the business side of pay myself to take time off, but then also start saving for the future vacation. So how would it feel to say the future vacation is now paid for upfront, and I have money set aside to pay myself to take the whole week off? It's an amazing thing.
It sounds liberating.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like I could breathe. Oh my gosh. How self-supportive and self-loving. You know, what a
I
beautiful
know.
act to give oneself. Yeah. And so you do talk about secondary income streams as a way to prevent against burnout. And this seems like one of those things. Are there any other pieces here around that?
For some people, it's just unpacking that noble poverty. Where did they learn it? Where was it reinforced? So typically, as a financial therapist, I start in the past, which is so cliche for our field, like, go to your family of origin stuff. But it's valid, right? We learned some things from them. It might have been things they spoke out loud. It might have been behaviors or modeling of what they did with money. And so, for a lot of the clinicians I serve, I invite them to start there if they're comfortable, because it has this nice domino effect on like money practices, which is like the budgeting and know what your numbers are doing, and then the financial freedom. That's that third bucket of the work. And so, if we start in the money healing bucket, folks go, oh, well, maybe I can have more self-compassion for why I feel the way I feel. Maybe I can pinpoint when I'm in scarcity, what behaviors show up there. Can I pinpoint mom or dad or caregiver's voice telling me, oh, that's a luxury. Oh, that sounds impulsive, or whatever's coming up there. And sometimes it's those voices that prevent the clinician from taking the time off or building the income stream. They call it imposter syndrome, but what if it's a parent's voice?
I love that. And what you said felt so important to me. I'd love for you to say it again. There's three buckets. Will you name them again?
Yeah, that's how I describe financial therapy to people who are like, what the heck is this? So three buckets of work: money healing, which is the past bucket; money present, which is like knowing your numbers, money practices bucket; and then the future bucket is financial freedom. And so past, present, future are the buckets of the work.
Yeah, and I'm imagining in that financial freedom, there's also a piece of an IRA and thinking about retiring, which is
That's right.
something that I didn't think about when I was a young new therapist. I just wanted to pay my bills.
I think all therapists, seasoned or new to the career, aren't really thinking about retirement. Like, so many people off the cuff say, nope, I'll think about that when I'm dead. Ha ha ha. And it's like, well, okay, is that also being reinforced at the grad school level, at the systems level? Like, why are all of us not sitting in that? In fact, just the word retirement can be pretty activating for clinicians for this very reason of like, oh, I should be thinking of retirement, but there's like a mental block here. There's a lot of work to be done just around simple words that are thrown out there and people getting activated.
I'm starting to see this as like really shining the light of awareness on how we relate to our financial state currently as it is, but also just what might even be lurking in the shadow of that, and where we can expand our edges based off of what we're familiar with rather than what we're familiar with, like where we really want to grow.
Yeah, I mean, it really speaks to something. I have like a bone to pick with one of the OG financial therapists. I don't know if he even identifies as a financial therapist. I think he's a financial psychologist. But there's a gentleman in the financial therapy space, which is relatively small in the grand scheme of psychology. And he likes to say, here are the four scripts of how you show up behaviorally with money. And I was like, great, great. I love the language. It gives language to something I'm doing. But then when you take a closer look at the four scripts, you're like, huh, none of these are healthy. None of these are actually what I want to move towards. And for me, that was a huge problem for me working with my clients, in this case, therapists. I'm like, cool, I've given you language and insight into where you are, but where are you going? And so I had to craft my own scripts of like, okay, here's the arc I'm seeing with the clients. They go from like this negative script to a more healthy script. And then how they get there is unique. Having a X on the map of like, I want to go towards here is so helpful for many of us.
To be able to see it so that we can actually live into it. And so I think you said you have 14 secondary income streams. And I'd love to just hear more about that and really what opportunities are out there for therapists to expand their income potential.
Yeah, so I think kind of the first three that I built and that I think a lot of clinicians consider naturally or organically would be things like supervision, so clinical supervision, consultation, and like training slash workshops or like public speaking. I feel like those three are very common natural next steps for us as clinicians. And sometimes that happens because someone's like, oh my gosh, I love what you're talking about one-on-one. Can you come talk to this Rotary Club? Can you come to this school? Can you do this at a conference? Can you come do a lunch and learn? And all of a sudden, we're in a new role. And so I feel like mine started in community mental health when I was still there, where someone's like, hey, we need to do some trainings for the team. Do you got anything? And I'm not someone who's afraid of public speaking, but I definitely had to like grow a little bit into it. And so I test drove a lot of my material on community mental health therapists that were brand new, right out of grad school, wanting to learn all sorts of things. And of course, I picked the heaviest topic I could think of, which was suicide. Not only did I test drive my speaking abilities, but how do I connect with a group of people who are going to be activated just by the topic itself? And that was back in like 2014. And so for a lot of folks, I think that's just a natural curiosity. Like, do any of those three things sound good to you? Like, do you want to be a consultant to a person or an entity or an organization? Do you want to supervise people? If so, what types of folks? Like early career clinicians, interns, licensed, or do you want to do some public speaking, which 70% of the world still has a fear of public speaking. So I know that's like a growth edge to get there. But those three come to mind first, and those are part of my 14 income streams as well. But I think for a lot of other clinicians, that's a starting place. Do you like any of these three? There's so many other opportunities beyond that, but those are the first three that come to mind.
When I'm listening to those three, I still see the there's like a fee for service, like I have to be there to earn this money. Yeah. And so when I think about the world we live in now, it's so different from when I first became a therapist. Like there's so much potential. And I know so many people build courses that are sort of a passive income and more teaching and stuff like that also, where it feels less of a like I still need to be here. Engaging in this very present moment way, which can be so taxing day in and day out.
That's right. So active versus passive, which is a conversation we should have because people are like, I want passive income streams, Karen. I'm like, I want that for you too. And they all start as active, right? You have to build something before it becomes passive. And in my experience, it takes 3 to 4 years for things to actually be passive, which is not something the crispy, burned out therapist wants to hear if they come into a consult with me of like, I want to build income streams. I'm like, yes, I will help you figure that out. But if they're already burnt out, it's really hard to hear. This will take 3 to 4 years to actually be hands off, no effort, passive. Now, you and I are both published authors, so that definitely is an example of passive income. Digital downloads, on-demand courses could be there, royalties from like a YouTube channel, a podcast, that kind of thing. But even some of those, when I say that out loud, I'm like, there's exceptions, like a little asterisk next to it of like podcast sponsorship, but it's not necessarily passive, right? It's still a lot of work. So the list of income streams that are active is much longer than the list of passive income streams because those take work to build. And sometimes it's about your market of like, is this actually marketable?
I often see therapists feel excited about starting something, but then that imposter syndrome or that fear of, is this going to be received, stops them. Is that something you see a lot?
Oh yeah, definitely. The imposter monster, as one person said to me, and I was like, oh, that's so cute. Like I like that phrase better. But it still has like this, oh, there's imposter in it. Sometimes I actually invite people to find like a little like monster figurine to like put near their spaces as they're building something, right? Writing the book, building the course, and like shove it in the drawer, put it face down, or whatever feels symbolically helpful. It's right there. But yeah, I think that shows up. And what I tend to have people start with is like there's kind of two ways I have people go with this first consult around secondary income. One question I ask them is like, what are you doing already that people enjoy? Like, what are clients coming to you for? What are colleagues asking of you? Like, just getting them curious about what's already happening that might be scalable. And then the other direction is like, what gift? What's the gift you're giving? And that feels so much more heartfelt, right? Like you and I who are like, oh, we really want this to like come through whatever we make. And so some people with the ooey gooey, they like the gift question, and others are like, no, I just need to think about what I'm already doing. And that feels like low hanging fruit. That feels a little less scary than starting something brand new.
I love that. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Gene Keys. Have you studied them at all? It's a whole framework and a map that's sort of like human design. I don't know it well, but when I learned my first key, I could see in myself that my imposter syndrome, my fear of public speaking, was a self-obsession that kept me from the heart of what I really wanted to offer. So I started making it about me being good enough, being perfect enough, and it drew me away from that deeper desire and intention to serve. And anytime I can remember that in the moment, it shifts so quickly for me, where I can just be here in my heart. So I love that invitation that you
Beautiful.
just shared.
Yeah, so hopefully
Powerful.
one of those questions resonates with listeners of like, which way do I want to go? Because it's still going to lead to work, right? As we've already established, like all of this is going to take work. Writing a book takes work. You've written several, I've written several. Launching a course, oh my gosh, so much work. I mean, with AI and some other things that are coming, maybe not so much work eventually, but it still feels like a lot of vulnerability, which is where that imposter monster shows up.
Yeah, a lot of vulnerability to put oneself out. The other thing is, I think that therapists in general really like being one-on-one. Like that's partly what draws us to this field is working one-on-one with somebody. And like the moment that we're outside of the therapy room and more eyes are on us, it can feel just so jarring.
Yeah, and I think because we know that our population is like majority introverts. I know obviously there are still extroverts, even in my network right now in my head, I'm like, well, yeah, they're extroverts. But I think because the majority of our field is female introverts, yeah, that one-to-one feels less draining than putting ourselves out there. But something else that's coming to mind is I don't know if you've read Tara Moore's book, Playing Big. Playing Big, I think is the title. And she's
No.
talking about women in leadership. And she's like, wow, we've been conditioned to stay small, to stay quiet, to not stand in spotlights of any kind. And that's some of the consultation work I do too, where they're like, oh my
Nice.
gosh, I can't put myself out there. What if I get burned? What if someone hurts me? And it's like, well, what's the cost of staying small? And what's the cost of playing big? And so having some like reflection around that is helpful.
Yeah, I love that. You mentioned something earlier before we started recording that just resonates with me. And that is my fear often is that other people are going to be jealous. And to me, that's like the worst thing ever. Like, I want everybody to
Yeah.
feel empowered and great in the world. And that jealousy, for whatever reason, I start to recoil if I have a fear of that. And that's part of that, like, really letting ourselves shine and be big.
Yeah, and hope that it actually like models it for other people, right? So
Yeah.
like I'm always the person wanting to reframe the ugly things that we think to ourselves. I'm like, well, what's the reframe here? The reframe is, yeah, I put myself in a spotlight, but it models to someone else they can too. Or I can
Nice.
be vulnerable, and that model someone else can open up and tell their story. Or I can put this really painful thing in a book, and someone else can be like, I feel so seen right now. Right? This
Yeah.
is why you and I do the things we do. It's like there is the risk that we'll be hurt. But the mantra I told myself for my most difficult book I ever wrote, which is now three books behind, I went from difficult back to like light again. But my most difficult book through the whole process, I told myself, this is going to help more people than it's going to hurt me.
Yeah.
And I had to say that every single time I sat down to write, because I was like, I don't, part of me didn't want to write it, but I knew I was going to at like a soul level. I knew when the event happened that spurred the book, I knew I was going to write about it right
It's so beautiful. I can feel that like deep in my belly. This is going to help more
then.
people than it's going to hurt me. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that reminder that we were just talking about of like the purpose as opposed to making it about us, staying connected to that purpose, which really is a muscle to build. You know, it's like it's
That's right.
something to develop in ourselves. Yeah, I'm just trying to think if there's anything else around secondary income streams that you think is important for folks to know or to consider. You had mentioned group practice. That I see that a lot right now, anyways, people wanting to start group practices. And it also seems like a lot of work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, depending on when you catch me and what mood I'm in, I have lots of thoughts on group practice because it also has evolved so much. Even in the last 5 years, it's changed so much. But when I was a group practice owner, I was a group practice owner for, I guess, 9 years, 8, 9 years organically because of the Medicaid piece. So I had people I worked with in community mental health come back to me under me working as a supervisor for them. And all my folks were licensed, so it felt like a little less management. But the question I asked people from the get-go is, do you like to manage people? And if the answer is a resounding hell no, don't be a group practice owner. Like, I don't care if you have interns or licensed folks or the candidates in between, you're still gonna have to manage people. And so for those introverted, I don't want to be in a spotlight. This is like in direct contrast to that. They're like, I don't want any of that, but I'll go over here and manage like 5, 10, 20 people. They fall out of alignment and then they start to burn out. So it has its benefits, but it's not a get rich quick scheme, however it's presented by the coaches of the world. It's a lot of work, energetically and otherwise.
You know, and I'm in all these Facebook therapist groups because I like to see what people are saying out there. And I saw this thread recently where somebody posed the question of, do you think group practice is exploitive?
The resounding question I heard right away was exploitive to who? But I would tell you it's exploitive to the clients, to the people who are hired into the group practice. Like, I don't know, I was curious about that,
Yeah, they
what
were
they meant.
talking about the 40-60 split. And
That.
I think it's interesting just to consider, like, I imagine that group practice owners don't actually make that much money because that split goes into sustaining the business, their time to
That's right.
supervise, their insurance, the rent, like all of the things, And so,
Yeah.
yeah, I think that there's a lot to consider when you're pre-licensed clinician, especially wanting supervision, but not wanting to go into community mental health.
Yeah. So in my head, I heard pick your poison because like there's pros and cons to all of it. Like I come from community mental health. I know that's like burnout central. Like that's a pipeline to burnout. And yet I learned so much as a clinician about what to do and what not to do in that system. And so when I think of the students I teach now as a part-time professor, they are very concerned about burnout, which is a good thing. Like they're actually like much more aware of that than ever. And they're more aware of their financial health, as you named, even with the high schooler, than generations that came before. And so I don't think it's exploitive because there's a colleague here in Colorado that put together like a dashboard that's like, this is how much it costs me to bring you on as a group practice clinician underneath. And at one point she calculated for a year and it was like $20,000 to bring them on for supervision that's built in, for benefits that are built in if you're a W-2 employee model, for all the onboarding and training time, right? So when I teach my private practice class to my students, I have them get curious about what is the cost to bring you in when you think of marketing, EHR, headshots, any of the things that they invest in for you. But even if we just fixate on just the supervision piece of what it costs per hour to supervise, that I think changes the exploitive word back to like, oh, now I get that this is expensive.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's such a unique field financially. Like really, truly. I've never seen in any other field so many people whose sense of self-worth is tied up in how much they charge or how many clients they have, and really just the whole insurance realm, which I've never billed insurance. I've been in private practice since the get-go, and so I've always opted out. And the more I learn, the more grateful I am to my younger self.
Yeah, stay away from this. Yeah, that's another broken system. So even when I said pick your poison of like community mental health or group practice, you know, community mental health, you're going to learn so much, but what if you have like questionable supervision, which is sometimes what I hear from our colleagues. You go into a group practice, you get hopefully a smaller caseload and more support, but it depends on if you're an employer or contractor model, right? And then insurance and all the things. So a lot of my income stream when it came to Medicaid was built because someone taught me how to work with Medicaid and community mental health. So, like, she was like, oh, you have a knack for this. I'm going to teach you how it works. And lo and behold, I could go build something, in this case, a group practice. So, I don't have any regrets about being a group practice owner. And I think it is a huge fit for certain people. But I think so many people are looking for financial stability and they think that's their ticket. I don't see it that way because it takes so long to build. I think there's a business professional, he said, the first year is for learning, the second year is for earning, the third year is for scaling. And I've got these folks coming in who are like, I should have X amount in my bank account in the first year. And I'm like, I don't think that's how it works, no matter how much you hustle. And that's ironic coming from me as a former workaholic. There's just a lot there for people to like deconstruct the narrative, check out any bias they have, but also the assumptions they're making about group practice.
Coming out of graduate school, having invested so much in the education itself, and then entering into the field with that sort of rude awakening of how long it actually takes to build a sustainable financial portfolio, I also think is unique to therapy. my husband had an undergraduate degree in engineering, and he graduated undergrad, was able to, be financially well. It's just so unique. As you were saying before, most therapists last 7 years. And so to get through those hurdles of that growing and scaling and all of that, and still enjoying the work and feeling the magic of being able to support folks in deep healing and transformation. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah, and even for those of us that like to work individually, like you named earlier, or like work in private practice, that can be very lonely too. So I'm seeing a movement, and every year it's something different. But like in 2025, it was people saying, you know what? I need financial stability. They're coming to me because they knew they could have this conversation in a safe space. And they're like, I'm considering shutting it all down and going and working for someone else for benefits, for healthcare, for stability. I'm like, I don't have to market myself all over the place. Like, stay on top of AI and SEO and all the other ways that people are found. And I looked at them and I was like, you need to do what's best for you in this season of your life. Because, like, I'm the queen of pivots. I pivot about every 2 years on something that I'm doing where I like put something to bed or rest and then I build something else. And that's just how my brain and my body like to work. And so I will normalize the crud out of anyone who needs to pivot because of life, right? Like, I had a daughter, my life pivoted. I burnt out, my life pivoted. I got married, life pivoted. Like, all these milestones that like make us change things up. So I don't think there is one right way to get there. But as we're thinking about that 7 year span, I'm like, does it take 7 years to find ourselves in the madness of it all? Maybe that's the reframe of like, does it take 7 years to like navigate getting licensed and supervised and eventually build something and then say, here's how I like to work? Just having that wondering as we're talking.
You had mentioned this is a while ago now, but the three income streams that you first present to folks, and one that you didn't mention there was coaching, which I see so much now in our field that therapists want to diversify by having a secondary coaching practice, which presents so much potential for dual relationships, just logistically on their website and all of the things. I'm wondering what your
Yeah.
thoughts are on that.
Oh, you want me to go to all the things
I
today?
do.
I tell anyone who wants to listen to me that I am not a fan of coaches, but like it's the bias I have towards the coaches who've hurt our clients, right? So as clinicians, we've had people who went to coaching first because it was like, you know, selling of snake oil, and then they got harmed because this person wasn't mental health trained, and then they finally come to us and we repair all the damage. And I don't like that at all. You know, I know most of us don't like that at all. So that's put this color on coaching for me. Now, I know of colleagues who have moved into coaching spaces and they've separated out two different businesses, which is what we're required to do in Colorado, where it's like strongly recommended that we have a therapy business. And if we're going to coach on anything, it's a separate business. And I never call myself a coach. Like, I don't identify as a coach. I identify as a consultant because to me, that means you have complete autonomy to take or leave whatever I present to you. And I really like that as a type A individual. But I think long story short, I just want people to be aware of what coaches, what it looks like to be a coach, right? So I want clients to stay curious of like, what is this person's training and background? What do they promise me? What promises are they making? Do they give advice? Of course, the coaching arm of things makes good money because they can offer packages and higher rates. But when you think about the baseline of someone could wake up tomorrow and call themselves a life coach, because those are the ones I like to poke fun at the most. So sorry, listeners, life coaches are it. But if you can wake up tomorrow and say, I'm a life coach, one, I have no idea what that actually means in the work that you do. And two, that feels exploitive of like, I'm going to take the fact that you don't understand what's going on in your own life. You're going through, there's a term called life quake, which is like a loss or grief that's happening, but not a death. My grief colleagues educated me on that term, and I love it. So, like, you're going through a life quake, and I'm going to exploit that and say that I'm here to coach you through it. I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I don't know if I like that. But then there are plenty of ethical coaches who are like, this is what I do. Here's my lane. I'm not your therapist. And here's a therapist referral if you need one. So, it's a lot of gray area.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's actually another ethical conflict I was thinking of while you were talking, and that is I see many therapists using coaching as a term to blur the lines of being
Yeah.
able to see people outside of their state licensure.
The
Because that's
Interstate
a
Compact will make that better once it's fully live on all the places. But yes, I've heard that too, where they're like, no, I just want to bypass our licensing board, not get, you know, grieved for this. But even as a financial therapist, I have a financial therapy organization that's responsible for my certification. But when it comes down to someone complaining about the work I do, they're still going to find my mental health license first because that's what's public facing and easiest to find. So like I'm trying to make this like distinction between all the things. The paperwork is different, the business is different, the website is different, is something people have to slow down and think about. Now, as a consultant, all of my stuff is branded as consultation, so it all lives in one place because I don't identify as coaching and I don't give advice. But, that's my own thing.
Do you still see therapy clients?
I have two left. Yeah,
Yeah.
two left.
Yeah,
One
it's
short term
interesting.
and one is my forever client. So.
Yeah, I rarely see individual clients, maybe for a week tops, and everything else, has transitioned.
And so I think to your point, it's just about having clear boundaries on what we do and what we don't do. And it's just an interesting phenomenon to watch colleagues go, I'm going to bypass the rules to see clients out of state, which the only reason I can see that is they're a college student and they're going off somewhere to college. Like that makes sense to me. But every other reason, it's like, well, help them find another provider in their new area, help them connect to their new community. Like that seems like the quote unquote good thing to do. But for folks who are like, no, I just want to serve people all over, then fine. Be a coach or be a consultant or call yourself a mentor. I mean, whatever label you put on it, but just be clear about what you do and what you don't do. And that's where it feels so different of like, we're not worried about that, but then we're worried about other ethical or unethical things we're doing to each other. And so we're grieving each other like it's a Yelp review. Like, what is happening? So those are like fighting in my head right now of like, sure, be a coach and see people wherever you want to see them because access to care is important. But then we're also like rigid about, oh, follow the rules, be ethical in all these other areas. Like, why do we have a blinder on for the serving people out of our state?
Well, and also to that end, if somebody is a therapist who is a coach to see people out of state, they can't do the same therapeutic techniques with them because you can't legally treat mental health illness outside of the state. And so you have to have a completely different set of skills and certification in order to
Right.
actually be able to do that.
So for my students, I like to put them in columns of like, here's how they're the same, here's how they're different. And they tend to have a reaction to the money piece because they're like, wow, I spent X amount on my education for a master's degree and I could have just gone and done this. And so that's always hard to watch them work through in class. But the rest of it is like, know your edges, know your, blind spots, but also like, what's the bumper? What's the bumper of this is now therapy and this client stays as a therapy client and they don't move around? Like once they're called coaching client, 3 months later, they're called a therapy client. Like none of that, as you said earlier, no dual role. I'm only one role with you.
It's interesting, the ethics of our field, I really value because the clarity of the boundaries. I think they're so important. And without them, I think the field would be even more of a mess. I think
Yeah.
it's so important to honor them. I'm just checking in, seeing if there's anything else here. Is there anything else here for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think for folks who are thinking about secondary income, they don't have to think about this in a silo or in isolation. Like, I think that's why there are several of us who like to talk to people about it. Like, I mean, I get as much energetic joy helping other people build stuff as building my own thing. So it actually feels like mutually beneficial to be a consultant to a colleague who's like, hey, I want to build something, I don't know what, but here's my creative juices, here's my thoughts. I get like a contact high from that, which sounds like so weird to put on a podcast, but it's my truth. And so you don't have to like figure it out on your own. You don't know what you don't know. So sometimes people just want to like pick our brain or like come in for a consult and say, just tell me all the things I should be thinking about. And for me, it's things like pricing, knowing your audience, timing of your launch. Like I don't presume to be an expert on any of those things, but I have a lot of lived experience that could be like, well, here's what I learned the hard way. Or as an entrepreneur, here's my failure. Learn from that. So I think that our colleagues like to come in to folks like myself and a few others that are like, hey, I'll help you build a secondary income stream. But I personally don't make promises of like, this is going to make you $1 million. Like that's where I think the coaching vibe starts to show up of like, if we're selling promises and we're saying things like, I can build you a full-time caseload in 30 days or any of that stuff, like, orange flag, pay attention to this.
You've given us so much to think about, Kara. Thank you so much. This piece around the financial buckets that you shared, and then also even just how to think about secondary income streams has been really useful, like passive or active, and what lights you up, and what is the gift that you want to give from your heart. It's been so beautiful. Thank you so much.
Of course, it's just the tip of the iceberg for a lot of folks, but maybe now they'll feel a little less intimidated to try one of those on or have a conversation about income streams.
If you found this episode meaningful and want to deepen into the practices of transpersonal counseling, check out our trainings at awakentherapist.com. We have live, online, and go at your own pace offerings that are designed to empower you to unlock the magic of psychotherapy. Thank you for continuing to learn the art of creating a truly sacred healing space for your clients.